Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing founder, you know, a founder that, you know, he has quite the story to tell. You know, they are doing remarkable stuff, you know, raised over a billion, you know, 400 employees alone in the US, another 300, you know, elsewhere. But we're going to talk about, you know, like what it feels to go from having under 15,000 people reporting under you to all of a sudden, you know, burning the midnight oil, with starting a startup. And then also what inspired him to do this, how he raised, you know, all that money, what differentiates them from other banks. You know, their solution is quite innovative. But again, riding a rocket ship and being able to talk about all the good stuff that we like to talk about, like building, scaling, financing, and so forth. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Colin Walsh. Welcome to the show.
Alejandro, it's great to be on the show. Thank you so much. And I look forward to telling a little bit more about the Varo story.
So give us a walk through memory lane, Colin. You know, you were born in Westchester. And so how was life growing up in the New York area?
Yeah, it was a great sort of place to grow up as a kid. And, you know, the good schools and lots of things going on. We were close to New York City. You know, I worked from a very young age, actually. So I was doing a lot of different jobs as a kid, even as a kid. So, but it was a very kind of vibrant place to grow up. And then I went on to college in upstate New York. And so I stayed in the New York area for most of my early life, but then had the opportunity to branch out into the corporate world. I started with GE and moved around a little bit with GE Capital, did my first stint at Amex in New York, so back to New York. And then I spent time out here in California, quite a bit of time with Wells Fargo. And it was a kind of exciting time to be at Wells. It was right after, actually, I came in right before the merger with Northwest. There was a lot of energy in the bank. I was growing businesses inside the bank. And so a little bit of a different world from today. And then got the opportunity to go to London and move to the UK and spent almost 9 years in the UK working at Lloyds Banking Group in the middle of the financial crisis and was able to do some really interesting, I'd say challenging things at the time as the banking industry was sort of teetering on the abyss and we had to buy our largest competitor. And I played a big role in integrating those two banks. And then I got called back to Amex and I did another tour of duty at Amex, which was kind of my last role in the corporate world. But to your point, you know, I was overseeing their European consumer business, had countries all across Europe that were, you know, under my watch. And it was an exciting, interesting role, but it left me with a real itch to do something that could help so many more people. So, you know, we were designing products for very affluent people in Spain and in Italy and in Germany. And you know, I wanted to figure out how to use technology in a way that could help the so many millions of people that are just trying to make ends meet, that are they're living paycheck to paycheck, that are trying to get more control over their lives. And so that ultimately is what inspired me to come back to the US and start Varo. And we can pick up on all the nuances of that journey because it certainly has been exciting.
Absolutely. We will definitely, you know, dig into the whole journey with Varo. Now, I guess, you know, before doing that, I'd like to ask, you know, how do you think it really shaped you to be able to see the financial services world, you know, from different regions, from different locations, you know, because you were able to experience that in the US, also in the UK, you know, working especially with Amex, you know, with different countries too. So how do you think that shaped your worldview and perspective?
Yeah, well, it certainly helped me understand more nuanced understanding of different consumers in different markets, what they need, how the economics of these businesses work in different markets, how the regulatory structures work. But also at the end of the day, you know, kind of build empathy for regardless of where you are in the world, you know, people have, you know, sort of fundamental needs. And if you are able to help people kind of early on in their lives and really at any point in their lives feel more in control of their money, because that relationship with money is so essential to how people feel about themselves and kind of their own self-worth. And so being able to help provide the tools and the products. And, you know, I had the fortune of being, good fortune of being able to build lots of different innovative products, but they often tended to be for people who were already pretty well served. And so the piece that I felt like I could take all that years of experience around how to make money in these businesses, how to understand regulatory, you know, how to navigate through regulatory structures, of understanding how to tap into sort of consumer interest and consumer demand, to be able to do something that could really make a difference in many people's lives. And so I think it's been wonderful to have had those experiences, particularly early on in my career, and being able to move into different geographies and different types of businesses. And so it gave me a strong foundation to start this company.
So then let's talk about to going from 15,000 people to no people. You know, I'm sure that was quite a crazy, you know, shift.
A lonely, yeah, exactly. Awakening when suddenly, you know, all your privileges of being able to, you know, fly in airport lounges and, you know, and early boardings and all the other stuff, like, you know, all the trimmings and trappings of a big corporate job go away immediately. And then suddenly, you know, you're asking yourself, like, wow, who's gonna do this analysis? Who's gonna build this financial model? Who's gonna write code? Who's gonna write policies? Like all of this stuff, like, you realize, like, wow, you really have to find that early team to do certain things, but you have to rely on yourself for so many things. And you know, fortunately, because I had those other experiences, I had a pretty broad network. And so I was able to reach out to people in my network, particularly as I was able to articulate what we were trying to do, the problems we were trying to solve, how we were going to go about it, and then draw in both talent to kind of help get that early start, but also investors and finding folks that believed that the future of banking was going to be digital, and that, you know, we were kind of writing history and on the right side of history, and that the world was moving much more towards digital adoption, whether it's the generational shifts with Gen Zs or millennials, or the huge market of consumers that were just not being served well by the incumbent institutions. And so being able to tell that story, being able to demonstrate how that business could get traction by building a very fulsome product offering that was meeting the needs of consumers much more broadly than just having a narrow app-based solution. And then the importance of being in the regulated environment and operating as a regulated institution. So all of those things were, you know, kind of in those early days, being able to tell that story, being able to get investors, get people excited about being part of the story and a part of the journey, were kind of those first, I'd say the first year was very much, you know, just trying to kind of get all those pieces moving and go pointed in the right direction. So, and again, I can unpack any part of that and then talk about sort of where we went from there once we actually had an MVP product, we had first investors in, and then how we started to scale the business.
So I guess for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Varo Bank? How do you guys make money?
Yeah. So we are what I would call, you know, a challenger bank or a neobank. I mean, we're an all digital bank, but what differentiates us from many of the competitors, particularly here in the US, is that we're the first and still the only consumer fintech that is operating as what I would call a tech bank. So we're tech first, but we are an OCC chartered national bank. We're a direct member of the FDIC. We're a direct member of the Federal Reserve. And we'll talk more about why that's important. And we're serving everyday American consumers. So people who are striving to get ahead and to get, you know, sort of feel more in control, have more agency in their lives. And so our business model is about how to create a platform that offers all the full suite of solutions. So if you think about banking, you know, just having a bank account and having access to free services that, you know, you don't have minimum balance fees, you don't have overdraft fees, all the things that have been fairly punitive to a lot of consumers, having payment options, so being able to move money quickly. And we have a range of ways to instantly move money in a secure and a free fashion. We offer savings products that are some of the best savings products in the country. So we have a base savings rate and then an elevated relationship rate that's 3% and then goes up to 5%. We have tools to help people automate their savings. So Save Your Change, which is a roundup feature, Save Your Pay. We offer credit building solution to help people who are either damaged their credit or just starting out and wanting to build their credit. And then we offer a lending product. analytics and budgeting products, all integrated into a simple, seamless app solution. So we really have built that full suite of products that a customer needs to get ahead. And as a result of that, we have very strong unit economics. So we make money on the flow. So when consumers deposit their paycheck, they tend to spend most of that money by the end of the, until they get to the next paycheck. So it's either going off the debit card or the credit rails. They tend to borrow because they might need a bridge or they might have an emergency expense. We also have a range of partners in our app where folks can go for a number of different services that we might not offer directly. So we monetize on the back of that. So it's a really quite diversified financial model. And over the last couple of years, we've been building out the lending side of the business, putting in place the right kind of risk management controls to be able to responsibly build lending. So that's now a bigger part of our mix. And if you look at some of the other neobanks today, most of their revenue is coming on the back of merchant interchange and particularly debit interchange, whereas we have a much more diversified sort of source of monetization of the business.
What was that moment like when really, you know, like you felt like you guys had product market fit where, you know, things were really working out and you're like, wow, I think that we're into something here.
Well, and in the early days, so I started the company, it's going to be 9 years ago at the end of October. But those first few years were all about getting product into market. We worked with a sponsor bank. So we worked with a partner bank to be able to launch, you know, what was essentially a debit card with savings features and a range of sort of checking account features. Then I almost would like to think of it as like proof of concept, just to be able to say, you know, my hypothesis and the thesis was that there's a large group of consumers who are going to benefit by having more of the low-cost banking solutions, you know, all digital, you know, available on their phone 24/7, want to have access to savings features. And that was very quickly adopted by consumers. And so while we were in that sponsor bank model, we, you know, continued to iterate on a number of features, but we could see that the product market fit was coming in pretty quickly because we were seeing the business scaling up. We had a relatively low CAC. And so we knew that like there's a bear there, like right away. But also while we were in that phase of, you know, sort of, let's say, testing the business through a partnership model, we went through a very rigorous process of applying to become a national bank. And that was a 3.5 year process. And so while we were scaling what I call Varo Money at the time, we were building Varo Bank. So not only did we have to go through an approval process with all three regulators, we had to have the right level of staffing, building out the right risk management systems, and building out an entirely new tech platform. And so you kind of got to watch what you wish for, because we got approved, you know, and everybody in the world was like, oh, you guys are never going to get approved. Like the regulators have never approved one of these, you know, and we had the right management team, the right understanding of what it takes to operate in a safe and sound environment. We had the capital backing. And so we got approved. And then we had to basically migrate that entire customer base onto the new platform while rapidly building out a lot of the product features that I've been talking about in terms of credit building and lending solutions and budgeting solutions and payment solutions. And so all of that has been built since we opened up our own bank and our own bank platform and had much more of that vertical integration. And the economics, the other advantage from the bank standpoint is that we were no longer sharing interchange or having the cost of having a sponsor bank. So it absolutely helped us very quickly, you know, on the economic side.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone, it's super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So you guys have raised over $1 billion. You know, that's a lot of zeros. So what was the journey of raising all that money like?
Yeah, well, first, having strong conviction from investors who saw the importance of what we were doing and the role that we could play in the industry and the size of the TAM that we're going after, and really playing the long game. I mean, really understanding that this is a you know, probably a 12-year journey to do this in the best possible way to get the foundation in place, to get the regulatory approvals in place, to be able to build out a platform that could scale, serving, again, this massive TAM of consumers. And so finding, you know, strong early investors like Warburg Pincus and TPG and HarborVest and Lone Pine and Gallatin. And we have a group of, you know, very impressive investors on our cap table that are, they see the long-term vision and the progress that we've been able to make as a company. Now, we've had to navigate through a lot of interesting sort of external factors. So right as we're getting the final stages, we just got our FDIC approval, COVID hit, you know, and everybody went remote. Nobody knew what was going to happen. You know, we saw a flurry of sort of competition because there was a lot of money flooding in for digital only services. So we navigated not just through the pandemic, but sort of a period of hyper competition where sort of CACs went up, and that then you had this big change that happened, you know, at the end of 21 into 22, where the markets just really froze up. And so capital was much more scarce. There was the interest rates started going up. Then you had a bank crisis where several banks like SVB and First Republic collapsed. And so there was like every sort of, should I say to the regulators, every stress scenario that we put into our original business plan, we actually lived through. And so kind of navigating through all of that, you know, at one point we scaled our marketing machine way, way back just to preserve capital and become much more efficient in terms of our acquisition economics, focused on our servicing, and we outsourced and offshored a bunch of our servicing operations, went much more into chat-based and AI-based service operations. We embedded AI into pretty much every part of our customer lifecycle just to become highly efficient while we were continuing to build out this product platform that meets the full range of needs for the consumers we're serving. And so it really did take a lot of investment to get the business, you know, scaled up, build the platform, build the product set, build the technology suite so that we feel like we are probably better positioned than ever to become the next, you know, major player here in the US in the digital banking market.
So the fintech space, you know, definitely has taken a lot of excitement from institutional investors, no? But obviously there has been a lot of newcomers, you know, a lot of companies, you know, competing for the same dollars from those institutional. So I guess in your case, you know, to be able to bring on board, you know, such caliber of investors, how were you able to position yourselves different from perhaps other banks and other solutions?
Well, and I think the fact that we were bold enough to say that to win in the long run, you need to be inside the regulated system. Like, I think that was something that certainly resonated with our big investors, that they understood that you couldn't really try to look for a regulatory arbitrage or have what, you know, I always described as a bit of an existential risk, that if you're working with a smaller bank and suddenly something happens to either that bank or another program that's working with that bank, that then constricts or constrains your activities for no fault of your own. Like that is sort of an existential risk. And so we wanted to control our own regulatory destiny. We also understood the unit economics that, you know, by having more of that vertical integration of both the tech as well as the banking, that we could deliver stronger unit economics. And there, I don't think there was any argument that there is just a massive TAM of consumers, both the folks that are, you know, and sadly, in this sort of the time frame that we've been doing this, it's only gotten worse for so many people who are living paycheck to paycheck, trying to make ends meet, that are looking to lower their costs of banking, they're looking to access affordable credit options, they're trying to build small dollar savings to create more resiliency in their lives. And this is just, this is everyday Americans everywhere. I mean, it's the person that's getting out of the, you know, Amazon delivery van. It's the person walking the dogs on the beach. It's the person stocking the shelves in Walgreens. I mean, these are people everywhere in this country that need these solutions. And so I think investors understood that there's a real need here, as well as you've got this sort of generational collision where you've got millennials that are now in their 40s, you've got Gen Zs that are in their 20s that have grown up with a phone in their hand. So like they're not going to go drive and, you know, wait in line to go to a bank branch. And so again, going back to the point I made earlier, like this is kind of on the right side of history, like that, you know, Varo has been skating towards the puck from the beginning. And then just being able to support us to build out the solutions and the technology platform to be able to effectively serve these customers.
So, you know, along the same lines of investors, you know, and talking about people, you guys have now 400 employees in the US and then also 300 internationally. Obviously, 300 is a lot, you know, outside of the, you know, where you have the culture, right? And then you have like all these different satellites of cultures, you know, going on, you know. So how do you manage that? How have you guys gone about having a united culture regardless of the location?
Yeah, culture is such an important question to ask. And you know, for any founder, you know, regardless of whether you're founding a company in your 20s or you're founding a company later in life, you know, it's so important to get that right. Because, you know, for me, kind of having spent many years in other large institutions, you know, I could see the things that worked well and the things that probably did not work so well, and had an opportunity to sort of build something from the ground up that focused on a set of values that were very, very customer oriented. And so there's, you know, our number one value at Varo is customer first. And then we talk about taking ownership and having respect and making it better, continuing to stay curious. And like sort of these are the sort of hallmarks and foundation of the culture we've built. And as we made decisions over the last couple of years to put certain pieces of our business in different parts of the world, being able to have, you know, culture carriers from within the core of the company to kind of work with those partners to make sure that those values are still lived in those different operations, those sort of more remote locations. And I did a trip out to, we have a group in India, and I visited them actually right before the pandemic. And they showed up, they were all wearing Varo swag, and they were like so excited about the things we were doing, and they were about to get the charter approved. And so I think it's important, though, to make sure that regardless of where in the world people may work, that they feel very connected to the mission and the purpose and the values of the company. And that is something that, you know, every founder has to work very hard to just make sure that that consistency is there at every step of the way. Because as I described before, you're going to have lots of twists and turns. You're going to get confronted with a lot of challenges along the way that, you know, some you can anticipate, some you cannot. But it's the culture that ultimately gets you through. And that if you have employees that really believe in what you're doing and they have a real strong sense of purpose, that they can be very resilient.
Talking about believing what you're doing, I mean, obviously that's not just from employees, but then also that's investors and that's also customers. So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Colin, and you have this snooze of a lifetime, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Varo is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah, to me, that world is one where everybody in this country, and maybe at some point in other countries, are asking themselves, why am I not on this platform? Why am I not using this solution? Because I think eventually, for me, it's all about just that sort of mass adoption of the solutions that we've built, because you can look at our app, you go to the Apple App Store, you know, we've got a 4.9 rating. You know, we have some of the best NPS scores in the country of any bank, you know, so, you know, and Google, I think we're a 4.7 rating, but the customers, you know, actually they're telling us, this is changing my life. And so when I wake up that morning and I think about what does the world look like, it's everywhere you go, you see people using the product and excited about it and, you know, raving about it. And that's the piece that's the excitement, what gets me excited. And I feel like we've come very far on that journey, and that's kind of the next step for us.
So talking about the future here, I want to talk about the past, because obviously you've been at it now for about 9 years with Varo, which is a lifetime. Eh? In the corporate world, it's like 100 years.
Keep in mind, Wells Fargo, Lloyd's was around for 300 years. I think Wells Fargo is over 150 years, and Amex, my other employer, is about 150 years. So like it's a drop in the bucket compared to some of these other institutions.
I hear you. But hey, it's a long time to be the founder and CEO, like really, you know, steering the ship now. If I was to bring you back in time, let's say to 2000 and let's say 15, no, or 2014, where you were like starting to think about maybe doing something of your own, like entering the world of entrepreneurship. And let's say you had the opportunity of having a chat with that younger Colin. What would be that one piece of advice before starting a business that you would give to your younger self?
I would say it's definitely not ever going to be a straight path, and to brace yourself for, you know, kind of all the kind of twists and turns that come with starting a business. And I think there are probably lessons learned around people. There are probably lessons learned around kind of how to sequence a product build, probably lessons learned around unit economics and what are the things that will work faster versus things that might take longer. And so I think, you know, there's probably a whole, I'll write my book someday and you can read it. You can see kind of all the lessons learned along the way. But I think that probably the biggest is just prepare yourself for the long game and the long journey. And I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think we've been very fortunate to have an investor group that has a lot of belief in what we're doing and sees that long game and the long vision as well. But I think that would probably be the biggest thing, is that there's no kind of, you know, maybe for some people there's a quick, you know, you start something and then 3 years later you're public. But I just don't think that's the reality for most founders.
So, Colin, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Sure. I mean, they can first visit our website at borrowmoney.com, and they can check out our product and learn more about who we are and what we've been building. And then, you know, I can be reached either through your platform or through the Colin@borrowmoney.com.
Amazing. Well, hey, Colin, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
It's been great chatting with you. Appreciate the opportunity.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.